I wonder what your gut reaction is to the words on your service sheet. The words, all should be well, and all manner of thing should be well. Perhaps they provoke feelings of cynicism or irritation. Or perhaps they resonate, suggesting a larger hope you can connect with. Julian of Norwich, who penned these words, was a Christian mystic living in the 14th century. We don't know much about her early life, but we do know she became an anchoress, living in a cell attached to the parish church of St. Julian in Norwich. And when she was around 31, during a serious illness, she had a visionary experience, recorded in a book known as Revelations of Divine Love. And it's possibly the first book written in English by a woman. Julian insisted that God is pure love and contains no wrath. She taught that anger and wrath are human projections which we put onto God. For her, God was love and offered forgiveness, regardless. She taught that sin was part of the learning process of life. And she also spoke of God as a mother, as well as a father. This was radical stuff for the time. And Julian's optimistic theology is all the more remarkable when we think of the period she wrote in. She lived amidst the horrors of the Black Death and the Hundred Years' War between England and France. It was a time of peasant uprisings, and the Catholic Church was in schism. In contrast to the priests of the day, who taught that misfortunes afflicting the population were punishments from God, Julian's reflections were a source of light and hope. But of what relevance are her words today? Is the notion that all should be well simply blind optimism which flies in the face of reality? I wonder if any of you have read the book Pollyanna, one of those childhood classics, one of those improving books of which my grandmother approved. It was published in 1913 by Eleanor H. Porter. And the main character, Pollyanna, is a young orphan who goes to live with her wealthy but stern aunt. And Pollyanna's philosophy of life centres on the glad game, an optimistic attitude learnt from her father. And the game involves finding a reason to be glad in every situation. It began one Christmas when Pollyanna, hoping for a doll in the missionary barrel, found instead only a pair of crutches. And making the game up on the spot, Pollyanna's father, who was a priest, taught her to look at the positive side, in this case, to be glad that we don't need to use them. So when Aunt Polly goes to live with her aunt and is put in an attic room without carpets or pictures, she enthuses about the beautiful view from the high window. When she's punished for being late to dinner, sentenced to bread and milk in the kitchen, Pollyanna thanks her aunt profusely because she likes bread and milk and she likes Nancy, the servant. With her sunny disposition, Pollyanna brings so much gladness to the dispirited New England town that she transforms it. She teaches others to play the glad game, including a querulous invalid and a miserly bachelor. And Aunt Polly too gradually thaws under her relentless cheerfulness. But Pollyanna's optimism is tested when she's hit by a motor car. She overhears the doctor say she'll never walk again and lies in bed, unable to find anything to be glad about, until the townsfolk visit, telling her how much she has helped them. The novel ends with Pollyanna learning to walk again and appreciating this all the more as a result of her accident. And the book was so successful that Porter produced a sequel, and 11 more Pollyanna stories, known as glad books, were penned by other authors, Pollyanna became known as the Glad Girl. And at the height of her popularity, a board game called the Glad Game was created. And Glad Clubs sprang up. And I have no idea what they do at such clubs. But apparently at least one still exists today in Denver, Colorado. And of course, tragically and very ironically, Denver is the place where we've heard of those recent shootings, those awful shootings in the news. In Littleton, New Hampshire, where the author lived, there's a statue of a smiling Pollyanna, her arms flung wide in greeting, and the town hosts a festival known as the Official Pollyanna Glad Day every summer. And the novel's success brought the Pollyanna principle, along with the adjective Pollyannaish and the noun Pollyannaism, into the English language to describe someone who always finds something to be glad about. And it's a term that perhaps unfairly is often used pejoratively for someone whose optimism is excessive to the point of naivety. So I wouldn't be surprised if all that gladness leaves some of you feeling a bit grouchy. It's easy to dismiss Pollyanna's optimism as just a sweet but naive approach to life. And certainly there can be something rather aggravating about people who put too positive a shine on everything, especially if they offer platitudes when you're in the throes of sickness or grief. You know the sort of thing. Cheer up, it could be worse. Or always look on the bright side. But perhaps we shouldn't dismiss Pollyanna's attempts to accentuate the positives totally. It's no bad thing to count our blessings, as long as we don't foist this practice too readily onto others. More disturbing is the positivity shown by the main character in Voltaire's satirical novel, Candide. Dr. Pangloss teaches that in this best of all possible worlds, everything happens from absolute necessity and is for the best. And this philosophy parodies the philosophy of Gottfried Leibniz, who believed the world was perfect and all evil a means to a greater good. Every twist of the plot, every natural disaster, every disease, robbery, or assault shows how absurd Pangloss's optimism is. He appears utterly blind to his own misfortunes, as well as the horrors endured by his friends, insisting everything is necessary for the greater good. And Dr. Pangloss's philosophy can be detected in some religious beliefs. The idea that everything that happens is God's will, and all will be well in heaven, so we should passively accept misfortune in this world. Or the New Age belief that we create our own reality, and pain and suffering is simply an illusion, a state of mind to be overcome. So how does this relate to Julian of Norwich's words that all should be well? Is it just a childlike assertion of the kind Pollyanna would make, or a Dr. Pangloss spin on suffering? I don't think so. Julian did not deny the difficulties of life, nor was she immune from them. As a child, she lived through the Black Death that killed nearly half of the population of Norwich. Some scholars suggest she may have married and lost her husband and children to the plague prior to becoming an anchoress. And she herself nearly died from serious illness. Julian makes it clear in her writings that belief in God will not shield her from suffering, whilst at the same time maintaining a conviction that the arms of love still hold her. In her words, "If there is anywhere on earth a lover of God who is always kept safe, I know nothing of it, for it was not shown of me. But this was shown, that in falling and rising again, we are always kept in that same precious love." Julian has an assurance that goes deeper than appearances. And it's the same faith that enabled the Apostle Paul to say in his letter to the Corinthians, "We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed." And it is a faith lived out in every place and age by ordinary men and women who refuse to despair and see reason for hope amidst the bleakest of circumstances. For Julian and St. Paul, it was their strong Christian faith, a belief in the unshakable love of God, that gave them a firm foundation for hope. Some of you may share a similar conviction. Others of you will not. But even if you do not share Julian's religious beliefs, perhaps you have a philosophy of life, a spiritual worldview, or some sense of ultimate meaning that enables you to make sense of the notion that all should be well. It could be a belief in the Buddhist principle of non-attachment that provides the possibility of transcending the cycle of suffering and duality. Or a belief in the goodness of human nature that envisages a world in which we will finally learn to live at peace. Or it may be a perspective that sees Earth as a self-renewing organism, capable of regeneration despite the threat we humans pose to the planet. And even if you can't believe that all should be well, even if it seems utter nonsense, on a psychological level, there is something to be said at times for acting as if it were true. In therapy, one technique for dealing with difficult emotions is to act the opposite of how you feel. For example, forcing yourself to smile or finding something to laugh about when you feel like crying. And such techniques are based on the notion that action precedes motivation. If we wait until we feel like smiling, we may wait a long time. But through the act of smiling or laughing, we stimulate the feel-good chemicals in our brain that create that positive emotion. This does not mean that we should smother painful feelings or deny the seriousness of problems. Too much forced positive thinking can be dangerous. But in certain circumstances, acting as if enables us to stay afloat in the sea of distress or pain. It helps us hold the opposite's intention. I feel sad, there is pain, sickness, or confusion in my life. That is a reality. But that is not the whole of all there is. And that is not the whole of who I am. I choose in this moment to enlarge my vision, to see what else is present and available to me. And this seems akin to the Buddhist doctrine of two truths. Relative truth is based on appearances and describes the experience of daily life in this concrete world. Absolute truth describes an ultimate reality that cannot be seen. In our limited perception, we suffer and hurt, but there is a larger reality which transcends human preoccupations and attachments. Now, some people argue that if we kid ourselves that all should be well, we become passive and we do nothing to improve our situation. But the opposite can also be true. Whilst the realists, the sceptics will insist we are doomed as a species, that climate change has gone too far, that war will be always with us. Whatever the truth of such assertions, if we listen only to those voices, what does it result in? Inaction. We do nothing. We become paralysed with the futility of it all. There's no point in trying if we're doomed. Whereas holding on to a more hopeful vision can spur us to take positive action towards that goal. Earlier, we heard one Unitarian response to the words of Julian of Norwich. And I'd like to read an extract by another Unitarian Universalist who has made Julian's words her own. Some words by Rosemary Bray McNutt. And I have edited them because they are rather long. And McNutt describes a journey towards faith that in some way mirrors my own. She says, I started attending the Community Church of New York, where there was no list of beliefs and no gatekeepers who decided on my worthiness. Everyone, including me, was part of a glorious creation. I was good and worthwhile. This was a revelation. For a long time it was enough, this freedom to think for myself, to embrace the spirit of skepticism and reject doctrine, fleeing the rigidity of childhood beliefs and blind, unquestioning faith. But I kept on living in a world filled with tears and tragic events that had no easy explanations. I kept on facing great joy and deep disappointment. I kept on being confronted by hopeless situations that unexpectedly came to amazing conclusions. And I continued to ask what it was I was experiencing. The answer came slowly. Bit by bit, I learned to acknowledge grace, came to believe the irrational idea that amid everything, there was a knowing, loving presence that abides in all things, even in me. I knew I could not explain what was gradually becoming clear to me. I only knew the truth of the mystic Julian of Norwich's proclamation that all will be well and all manner of things should be well. At the same time I was comforted by this notion, I remained suspicious of it. How could all be well when I myself had spent a childhood in which all was definitely not well? How could all be well as long as people cried out for justice and bread? I had no answers to the questions, only the continuing sense that there is so much more to our lives than the horrors we inflict on one another and the blessings we bestow too rarely. And then one day, on retreat at a women's conference, I joined in a sacred spiral dance. Invited as part of the dance to speak to the divine and listen for an answer, I joined in, impatient, sceptical, and freezing cold. As I made a perfunctory list of my concerns, I suddenly felt a presence that made itself known in every cell of my body. It was followed by a voice, neither male nor female, and utterly unlike anything I had ever felt. And the voice told me lovingly, "Don't worry, my child, don't worry." When I spoke to the voice about the hopes and dreams of my life, the secret desires I carried with me, it promised me all these things and more. And then the voice and the presence left me, and left me changed forever. Some words by Rosemary Bray McNutt. And I ask you to resist the temptation to analyse this experience or explain it away or dismiss it, as we Unitarians can be prone to do. I share it as an example of a truth I have found evident in my own life. It contains a statement of faith that cannot be proved or disproved. People will continue to argue there is more evidence to show that all will not be well, that we are alone in this universe, and that humans will end up destroying the planet. Yet still I hold on to the conviction that in the greater scheme of things, beyond human understanding, there is reason for hope. And this hope is grounded in something larger than myself, which I choose to call God. This faith enables me to live more joyfully and confidently than I could otherwise do. But I'm not trying to force my faith onto you. It is up to each of us as individuals to find a worldview or philosophy which we can live by. For some of you, that may be a spiritual truth. For some of you, it may be a psychological technique that enables you to be more positive in your outlook. But I leave you with the invitation to experiment with the notion that all should be well, to hold the opposites in creative tension, not in denial of problems, but in a refusal to let despair have the last word, to make a conscious choice to live and act as though all should be well and all manner of things should be well, and to see what difference it may make in your life. And so may it be.